Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm your host, Jack Powell, on faculty with the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, good to see you again.
Thank you, Jack. I'm glad to see you too.
Happy post-Independence Day.
Yeah, it's the day after Independence Day.
Right. And as of recording, it's the day after Independence Day.
That's right. We had a great time yesterday watching some fireworks get eaten by mosquitoes, eating hot dogs, that sort of thing.
I had a great time yesterday.
Fried chicken, actually, for me.
Drenching in sweat in front of the grill. It was my first time grilling.
Oh, yeah, you were grilled. All right.
Yeah, very good. My first time.
How did it turn out?
Well, everything was burnt.
Everything was burnt.
And I accidentally melted the lighter that I used to, like, light the grill.
Wow.
I, like, set it next, because I have, my dad has one of these, like, a grill that, like, has the grill part and then two, like, little shelves stuff on the side.
Right.
And I
sat. But they're very close to the heat, aren't
they? Very close to it. And I sat the, like, lighter just down there not thinking. And, after, like, 10 or 15 minutes, I looked at it and saw that it was all completely melted and warped.
And all the lighter fluid, all.
But unfortunately, none of the lighter fluid got out because that just would have turned into an explosion. But the wrong kind of explosion on the 4th of July. But so everything was burnt, and I melted the lighter. Happy 4th of July.
Good.
So,
yeah.
So my brother was proud of me. He was like a rite of passage.
You've used the grill.
I used the,
You've
the
become
whole,
a griller.
I beheld the holy grill.
Not the holy grill. I told them we already have one. That's funny.
Makes feche lavash mean a whole new thing.
Feche lavash, right.
For
the holy grill. Feche lavash, that's hysterical.
Okay.
Oh, man.
So as you can see, we're being very cordial and civil with each other.
We are being civil.
I didn't, this discussion.
Yes, that's right.
I bring up because... And my brilliantly smooth as butter segue.
Mr. Segue, we call you.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
So, like, our last podcast, we used an article about racial reconciliation to springboard into talking about how we talk to each other about difficult things or anything, really, in our socio-political discourse, which is just my fancy $2 phrase or term for, like, how we talk about societal and political things in the public square.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically how we do. The terms we use and the way we engage with each other. And some of the ways we engage with each other are unhelpful and not very helpful and stuff.
Right.
And one thing this was segueing into, I use the word segue again.
Segueing. You're just verbing then, I guess.
Yeah,
you're just turning a noun into a verb.
Verbing weirds language.
That's what I heard, yeah.
One thing that's come up lately is the issue of civility.
Civility, right.
Certain things. So at time of recording, certain things have happened that may have already been forgotten. I mean, may have already been forgotten now. Because, like, Justice Kennedy is retiring, so everybody's talking about something else.
Right.
But when this issue was first cropping up, there were two things, main things that were going on. You could say three. One was Trump got elected.
Right.
So, like, that affect our discourse. But specifically, two things recently was, one was the kind of fiasco or whatever the heck was going on at the border with the separating of families, and like what was really happening and whatever. Were children being thrown in concentration camps? Was it not what everybody thought it was? Just devolved into the most, like, again, as usual, the most horrible, demonizing, vilifying, grandstanding, chest-thumping nonsense that usually gets...
Everybody heads to his corner and then lobs grenades at each other.
Basically. And then the second thing that happened is that Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she got, like, booted out of some restaurant somewhere because she was Sarah Huckabee Sanders. And that caused a whole firestorm of, like, which really got... as Ben Shapiro would call it, turned into the vortex of stupid because it sucked up the whole, like, you know, bakers refusing to bake cakes for same-sex marriage. It's like, well, whose side are you on now? And the point is regardless of what you feel about what happened at the border or immigration policy, regardless of what you feel about Sarah Huckabee Sanders or a business's right to refuse service or whatever, the conversations that arose about them were just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the most part, were horrible because they typically are. Okay, they typically are, at least... the conversations that happen on the interwebs and on, you know, news shows and stuff like that.
Right.
And something that came out after it was, I think it was Maxine Waters gave this speech that sort of was like the the central avatar for all this. Mm-hmm. I don't think she created all this, but she was like the focal point for it. When she said that you ought not, I'm horribly paraphrasing her, okay? So like, people need to go see what she actually said. But she basically said, you know, good, you ought not to serve them, and you ought not to tolerate them, and you ought not to so right. on and so forth. And it created a new horrible discussion about civility.
Yeah, yeah.
There are some people who are saying, you know, civility is just a tool of oppression to silence people and, like, make them look like they can take the high ground against uh-huh. others who are, like, complaining. It's a maintaining of the status quo, you know. And there are other people who are like, civility is how our society holds together, all right? If we can't be civil to each other, then the whole thing's going to be torn apart, and we're going to, it's just going to be barbarism.
Right.
And so, you got me to thinking about it, because, like, civility just seems like, that seems like a good thing. But what is it? Why is it? Why does it matter? Mm-hmm. Are we even using it correctly? And so on. So it just seemed like a natural segue from like how we talk to each other, how poorly we talk to each other, and the idea of civility just seemed to go together.
Right. In some way. Right, right. Yeah, civility certainly is at the root of civilization, isn't it, as a word? Mm-hmm. Civility is a way of treating one another with certain dignity. And that a civilization requires that certain dignity and interchange. We read the Orestia trilogy partly because it's a good example of how the Greeks called their society out of barbarism. Mm-hmm. Right? They were basically running blood feuds for justice. That's how they managed. And the Orestia, the third book of the third play in the Orestia. Brings about a whole new way of justice, and I think it ushers in civility for the civilization.
Right, brings in specifically they bring in the jury system,
exactly,
which is like hearing the person's arguments, judging and weighing it, and then trying to come to some sort of consensus.
Right, and allowing your peers to decide that means that you don't have to actually. Take justice into your own hands anymore.
Right.
Those who are not involved in the squabble actually can look at it more clearly than the two that are. But there's another element that occurred to me when we were talking about it last time, about civility, about how it is that we spend so much of our time in debate or interchange or flaming, frankly, at each other. I wouldn't even call it debate. We do it in media. We do it in absentia, in a sense. We don't actually sit down and talk to each other face to face. We write tweets at each other. We write Facebook posts at each other, and we basically have. I think the technology, although I'm for it. In general, I think one of the downsides of the technology of these. Interchanges is that it takes some of the governors off of our tongues. Maybe when you sit across from somebody like you and I are doing now, and you have to see the face of the person that you're talking to and making sense of, and you have to, in a sense, be vulnerable enough to hear the other person do the same with you. You guide your tongue, you guard your tongue a little bit more, I think, you know?
Or at least there's an impetus to do so.
Right. I mean, you may still fly at each other, but it's in a sense, if you're sitting in your bedroom typing away on your laptop or something, far away from anybody that you actually are addressing directly, or perhaps even arguing against somebody that you only know by reputation and not in person.
Right.
I think Donald Trump is this horrible person. I think Hillary Clinton is this horrible person. Mm. It's a lot easier to just vent.
Yeah.
And that simply raises the temperature of the conversation, you know, immensely. You vent, and then the person that disagrees with you vents back at you, and so if you combine that sort of distance and the lack of governor that you have on your tongue that comes only, I think, from being in proximity to each other. You combine that with a general inability to debate to begin with. Hmm. You know, I think then we've got the the makings of an explosion, frankly.
Sure. It's reminding me, because this is complicated, all right? Like, what you're saying...
Everything with you is complicated, Jack.
I like to be, what did I say? I like to be excruciatingly nuanced and noncommittal.
There you go. So,
like, in my responses to things. Everything you're saying about like how that's how what happens when things vent and raise the temperature is true. The complex part, I guess, is it's reminding me of, I can't remember what dialogue it was in, but in one of the Platonic dialogues, he tells mm-hmm. that story about the Egyptian king, and there's this one god who meets him and shows him all these cool inventions, and one of them is writing. And,
right.
And the king says, and I think also, didn't Neil Postman bring up the same?
He did, yeah.
Same
in,
idea.
In Amusing Ourselves, or in Technopoly. Technopoly. Right.
The god comes with the invention, and the king doesn't like the invention of writing because he thinks it will like encourage misinformation to just stay around. It'll also do two ironic things, like paradoxical things. One is it will allow misinformation to stay around,
mm-hmm.
and then two, it will encourage forgetfulness.
Right.
Right.
You won't use your memory,
which could feed into each other, right? Misinformation is the only thing that stays around, and then everyone else forgets what actually happened, and so all they have is the misinformation.
That's right. That's right.
And Plato used this idea. I don't know exactly what he said, but the idea seemed to be like there's a danger in communication being mediated through some kind of technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is why like Plato preferred dialogue. Right, he preferred like face to face, sit down between two people trying to discuss something, because somehow that type of interaction can help arrive at the truth better. Because like,
and the truth is in his mind a third thing than either of your opinions.
Yeah,
right. So it appears between you somehow as the two of you chip away and redefine and clarify and so on.
Right,
it becomes clear to both of you.
Right, Richard Weaver said it was something that's supposed to flame up between the two.
Between the two,
right,
of you,
rather
exactly.
than be, so that's the only flaming that should happen in a conversation. I say it's complicated or complex for a couple of reasons. One is. Obviously, Plato's dialogues were written down,
right?
Right, and now they are preserved.
Sure.
And Socrates, as a character, always had some weird relation to the arts about like in the idea of representation and how representation can be deceptive and problematic, and we have to be very careful with it.
Right.
You know, boot all the artists out of the Republic or whatever, something like that, or all the poets.
All the poets.
And so there's that.
And certain musical modes.
But then the dialogue was written down, right? And we have a podcast by which we're using communication and stuff. It's right. like technology, communicative technology is sort of unavoidable. So that's one thing. And also, I might disagree with Socrates just a little about the nature of like the written word and whether it actually is a dialogue with something else. But that's another discussion.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
The other complexity is...
Just to make that point,
yeah.
we would both probably say that engaging with the book is closer to what Socrates intended for a dialogue between two people than the kind of thing we're talking about today,
yeah.
where there's no debate going on. We're just flaming at each other and so on.
There's some kind of life.
Or just sitting in alone and opining.
Right. There's some kind of life in a text.
That's right.
That's still there. That's still like being confronted by it. But the other complexity of it is we've talked on this podcast before in the past about the goodness of mediation.
Right.
Right. Of like how there's something about a society that wants things immediately. That's not good. That institutions that mediate things, you know, I think like a mediation between like the government and the marketplace is, we've talked about that before.
That's right.
And that could probably help solve a whole bunch of problems. Not perfectly, but it would be a better solution. Some sort of mediatory agency that helps us engage with each other and work with each other. Society is a good thing. Yet here, to put a little wrinkle into that, it almost is like means of mediation, and I'm looking over at my iPhone because that's a means of mediation. It seems like there is a way where mediation can be not good in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Where the mediation, rather than just being a way we can actually connect to each other, is like a barricade or a blockade between the two of us from actually engaging with each other.
Right.
Because I assume there are things in this room right now that are mediating our conversation to each other. You know, our clothing. just mean it.
Yeah.
Like we
the
actually
atmosphere that carries your word to
right.
my ear.
Well, I'm thinking like social things.
Oh, okay.
You know, like you
okay.
know the fact that we respect each other courteously enough to not stand here in our boxers and briefs or something
right.
like that.
Right.
Or
right.
Certain sort of social mores, you call them the governors of the tongue or whatever that or whatever we want to say those things are,
uh-huh.
are sort of like mediating how we engage with each other.
Okay.
Things like social media, because there's the word media, mediation, right?
Right, right?
Is another form of mediation, and yet there is a question about whether it's actually helping our conversations, helping our dialogue, or whether it's hindering.
Well, that's a good point. Let me go back to Postman for a minute. I think Postman's point of bringing up that dialogue was to say there are pros and cons to every technology, and the point he's making, of course, is that there may be very, well, pros and cons to even the technology of writing,
right?
Which we take for granted now, right?
Right.
So I think it's fair for us to evaluate every technology, even your iPhone there, for pros and cons and see what kind of limitations it gives. It's not that you want to dismiss the technology out of hand because it has some cons, mm-hmm. but it may very well be that you can offset those cons somehow by knowing about them, mm-hmm. you know. So, yeah, I think in technology, that's the way it goes. I think in mediation, the point about mediation that Weaver makes and maybe others too, it seems to me that we can't actually have any kind of communication without mediation of some sort. So even the language we're using now to talk to each other is a medium.
Right.
Right. So all the arts are media, as well as the newscasts and the social media that we talk about using all the time. And if we take Postman seriously and say that there are pros and cons to every form of media, every medium has its pros and cons, then it might be wise to know what the weaknesses are of a certain medium in order to sort of compensate for those. You know?
Even Socrates, who would like say about, you know, writing and the dangers in art, even he knew the dangers in speaking, right? Mm-hmm. Like he was, the sophistry was something he was always against. The
absolutely.
Sophistry was a form of like fallacious speaking. And not just
so you
speaking.
Can actually craft your words in a way that misleads your opponent, or leads your interlocutor away from the truth.
Yeah, when I'm in my like literary theory class with a good professor,
yeah.
they talk about like the beginning of all literary theory as we understand it goes back to like Plato,
mm-hmm.
and because of course it does, in the Western world at least, and there's what's called the problem of representation,
mm.
what they call it, that all the means by which we try to represent things are, I'm not sure if the word flawed or problematic in some way,
right.
like some way.
Right.
And how we respond to the problematic depends on who you are, but it's like we have to respond to that problematicness. Like, how do we, whether we respond to it, the most extremes would be like we respond to it by saying it's so hopelessly distorted that there's no way to ever get at any truth or knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right? Like a
mm-hmm.
super nihilistic position. Or some hyper, on the other end, it would be like a hyper rationalist position, which says that there is such a thing as a pure mediation. As a matter of fact, there's such a thing where mediation goes away. You just receive the truth. You know, it falls like
mm-hmm.
manna upon your reason,
mm-hmm.
or something like that. And, of course, we can get it, you know, unfiltered and unmediated. So there's, like, the two extremes of it. But this issue of, like, representation and mediation, if you want to put it that way, of ideas or of ourselves or of anything, has been a conundrum of,
right.
I think, most philosophy, especially Western philosophy, have 2,000 plus 3,000
yeah.
years or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah, it's interesting that even, you're right, I mean, there is a sort of end of the spectrum where a thought or something comes to you almost without mediation, and that's kind of spiritual enlightenment or something. I don't know what that is,
yeah.
Just an idea in your head. But in order to be able to make it communicable in any way, it's got to have some sort of medium.
Yeah.
Right, even if it's just the voice through the air, you know, to the other person. So maybe God can speak to us by way of the Holy Spirit in the deepest parts of our hearts, and we have a kind of unmediated thing. But certainly the picture that we have of God is through the person of Jesus. And so the incarnation even is a mediation of God to us.
Right.
So in every case, I think we have a kind of external reference point of mediation, which is like the Platonic notion that, or the Socratic notion that, that truth arises in the midst of those who are conversing and not just in the mind of one person. I think what Weaver's talking about in his chapter on the great stereopticon in his book, The Ideas of Consequences, is that the medium does sort of adjust or limit or spin the information. The form of it and then the content of it are actually welded together in such a way that the form can bend the content. What he talks about is the stereopticon, which is the old-fashioned, you know, two lens viewer, where you have two different pictures, one for each eye, and when you look through the lenses, your eyes focus those two pictures together and imply a kind of 3D reality. But it's not really 3D; it's two pictures that are in two dimensions. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the newspaper becomes a stereopticon. That tells you you're looking at reality, and in reality you're not looking at reality.
It's a very oddly, almost like proto-postmodern kind of way to look at it. Because if you take postmodernism and barring its like nihilistic foundations, it has a similar idea that all information, all reality, like what's out there, is always filtered through somebody's interpretive lens,
right?
To somebody else's interpretive lens, right? Like
that's right. The writer for the article, or
right. So it's like the writer writes and is filtering reality through their lens. Then the reader who reads that is filtering that.
That's right.
Like there's always mediation and interpretation going on all the time.
Exactly.
And again, with the problem of representation, is that a good or a bad thing? How does it go awry? Does it go awry all the time? The postmodern thing is that everything is mediation interpretation. All mediation interpretation is fundamentally arbitrary and not connected to any sort of reality at all,
right,
other than your own sort of self-expressive reality. And thus, in a weird way, everything becomes suspicious, and yet everything has to be valid because there's no way for you to know. Mm-hmm. Like if any statements are true, you have to at the same time be beholden to none of them and yet allow all of them to speak, like all at the same time.
Right. Right. Now, and I think the way that Weaver addresses it, of course, is kind of pre-postmodern in the sense that he still thinks that there's a truth out there to know.
Right.
It's just that truth gets distorted to such a degree by the medium that it can't be taken as reality by itself.
Right. Well, it doesn't seem like within that sort of context, it doesn't seem like it's the medium that's the problem, but it's the people who are using it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think he would argue that it's the medium itself, too. It may be the opinion of the person doing the writing, but there's a limitation in, for example, for the newspaper. If you're putting out a daily newspaper, then you're writing for people who are going to read it very quickly, and you have to keep up a schedule of putting out something every 24 hours.
Right.
And so built into the sort of schedule of writing for a newspaper is a certain superficial treatment of whatever subject you're really going to address. Unless you're going to take 6 months to write your article, and everybody else is going to take 6 months to write their articles, and each one comes out every day, you know, and you have enough people to do that. What happens is you have a deadline every day, and you have to come up with something to write about. And so if your job is to write about the troubles in Sarajevo, well, then you really can't give a very thorough and profound description of what's going on over there if you only have 24 hours to research it.
Right. If you're like someone, if you're a writer who gets tapped, like, hey, we need you to write an article for whatever on this topic, if it's something that you're regular doing and you just have to spit out stuff all the time, it's real easy to just like fall into like, well, here's my standard form for what I'll say, here's my standard talking points.
That's right.
So like the medium Because what I was getting at first is that if there's because distortion feels like that's a moral agency thing. Like, you know, if there's distortion going on, it's because somebody's deliberately distorting.
Right, right. But it isn't necessarily that way. For example, let me throw out one more example. Various media in the arts are good at certain aspects of truth. So, for example, maybe a statue like the one here, where a moment's frozen in time, is good for contemplation. You can sit and contemplate that statue and all that it stands for. We're looking at the Canova Cupid and Psyche on my table here, the model of it.
Not the original.
Not the original. Well, the original is here, but the copy now is in the Louvre, I think.
Oh, yeah.
No, wait, that's the other way around.
Right.
The other way around.
If you had the original Hodges, your table would never support it.
That's true. No, what I'm saying is the medium of sculpture, that is taking a piece of stone and carving it into that, allows for you to contemplate in a way that, say, film as a medium doesn't. Mm. It's a different kind of thing. Thinking is not something that you can depict very well in a film. Because the film is about movement. It's about visual movement, right? Mm-hmm. And when people are thinking, they're not usually moving around. There's not energy going on. If, in fact, a film of somebody sitting and thinking would be a very dull film.
Right.
So, but you can do that kind of, you can sort of look at a statue this way, and you can, in it as a medium, grasp some of the depth of the reflection that's going on in the mind of the artist and the mind of your own mind at the time. That's not to say that films can't say profound things. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
They can. But they do it in a different medium. They do it in action. They do it in movement.
Even in regards to thinking, I mean, they can represent, like, thought. Like, think like in those Sherlock Holmes movies with, like, Robert Downey Jr., they would have moments where they would have Sherlock show his thought process as he was going through things, like, you know, if I hit this part and then like that. But it was all like you were seeing the movement and the action. It was the thought process actually worked out as a physical process on the screen. It wasn't just him sitting there thinking it. You would actually see it visually be
right.
represented.
That's right.
Which, like, again, is a different thing than just like looking at a still thing, and the thinking is mostly done by you.
Right.
Right. So yeah, right. So mediums are all different.
And the subtlety of the carving can allow for the means, the thoughts of the carver, the artist, to come through to you, just in the same way that the medium of film or some other medium can do the same thing, that the artist is actually thinking something, he represents it through the medium, and you get it. It's just that there are different things that they represent better. So there's a limitation, I think, to statues. There are pros and cons to statues in terms of what they can get across. There are pros and cons to film. What I think Weaver is saying is that one of the problems with the daily newspaper is that it has a hard time being very profound. Mm. And the problem he had with movies, interestingly enough, was because he had three things in that chapter, if I remember right. I haven't read it for a while, but I used to teach it all the time. Film and radio and newspaper. And what he said about the film, if I remember right, is that we censor movies. We get offended by movies based on two things: on the nudity or the violence, maybe three things, maybe the language. And he said when we look at films that way, we're missing the real damage. The real con of the film is that it makes you interested in and associate yourself with and identify yourself with a character who is often terribly flawed and is portraying character traits that you wouldn't like to have and that you wouldn't want in your friends, but because you're watching it on the screen, you embrace it because he's an attractive person, she's an attractive person. And so it offers you self-absorption or desire for material gain or, be motivated by covetousness, for example, those sorts of things. And he says that's the real danger. Those guys look so attractive, they seem to be so much fun, and they're offering you a way of looking at the world, but that way of looking at the world, if you scratch a little bit, is not really something you want to associate yourself with.
Yeah, it's that complex matrix of the thing. It's like the medium does something to the message, and the person giving the message is also involved with it, and the person receiving it.
No doubt that all three of those aspects are involved.
So all three of those aspects are involved. And one of the big media things of our day and age, one of the artistic mediums, is, say, like we said, social media.
Right.
If there is this matrix going on, this matrix of the author, shall we say, the medium and the receiver, mm-hmm. I guess we'll put that, mm-hmm. those three things. So those may be poor words for it, but those three factors
right.
are involved. And how they each affect things, then how would that, so what are the, in light of that, what are the pros and cons of, say, Twitter? We can argue about what was the point of it, which most, from what I hear from most Silicon Valley types, you know, things like Twitter and YouTube and all social media was about creating connectivity.
Right.
Like somehow, it was kind of utopic, all right? Uh-huh. And his view is like, if we just somehow create connectivity, if we use communication and tools of communication and means of communication to break it, to like, you know, over, you know, step over boundaries and barriers and connect people to each other, somehow that'll create peace on earth in some way.
Right.
And
right.
The thing is that where it gets purchased is kind of what we were already, how we started, that when you actually are in connection with someone, you know, mm-hmm. not just like face to face, but also face to face with some, the more connectivity you have to someone, there's more difference in how you deal with them, right? Mm-hmm. If you're just an icon on a screen and text, then I can just blast you and your mother all day, right?
Right.
But if you're a person sitting in front of me and you're a person I know and you're a person I care about,
yeah.
then that shapes like the way I deal with you and somehow brings some level of the, you said those social governors on you. We could call it like graciousness or courtesy or civility, but whatever, these things come in, these maybe hyper-rational things, these things we can't reason to, come in mm-hmm. and change the way I deal with it. There is something to that.
Right.
But their idea was that, okay, well, if that's true, then let's take that and put it into this larger media of the internet and just do it all across the world.
Yes, right.
So that was like the fundamental idea.
And that, I think there's a certain naivete in that because
sure.
face-to-face communication and virtual communication are not the same kind of communication, it seems to me. So whatever the differences are, is what we need to talk about. In the of the three things, let me go back to your three things a second. The author, the medium, and the receiver or the audience, right? The three of them.
Audience may be better.
Maybe whoever's hearing audience. Of the three of them, the author and the audience are always going to be with you. The only question is what's going to be between them. Mm-hmm. So. Because as you and I are talking, for example, you and I even right now are trying to narrow down or hone in on a kind of problem that we both see that neither of us is sort of getting at just exactly right yet. That's why we're still kind of working it out. But so there's always going to be one and another. There's going to be an audience and there's going to be an author. And the question is then, what effect does the medium have on that interchange? It's difficult enough, even if they're face to face. So, what happens in the social media, I think, is that the proximity of the two people is extended. They don't have to be in the same room to be able to hear each other.
They don't have to be in the same state.
They don't have to be in the same country. Exactly. So the question is, what happens to the communication when it's done in such a way that the other person doesn't have to be there when it's done, when it's heard? We've always written letters to each other, haven't we?
Yeah.
So the idea of writing something electronically shouldn't be all that much different than writing something by way of letter
to someone who's far away.
Yeah.
Right.
So what's the difference between a letter and a social media post? Well, it's the audience. Because I may write thinking I'm writing to you, but another 10,000 people might actually read it.
Right.
So I know that I'm speaking into a kind of public square, right? And in that case, there's a certain, dynamic maybe that comes about of fear of the opinions of the masses or something, right. You know. And so maybe I'll say to you, if I were in person with you, I'd say, I really don't like the tie you're wearing. But if I'm saying it on the social media, and I know that everybody else is going to, you know, side with me or side with you about your tie, you know, whatever, then I might say, you know, Jack's taste in ties is the worst possible. I've never known anybody worse than Jack about his taste in ties, right? And then people say, yeah, you're right. And that makes me feel very good. Or, no, you're an idiot. His taste, you know, whatever. And so it sort of bifurcates the audience. But I'm always, I may be speaking about you or even to you, but I'm including sort of this whole audience of people that are going to side with me or not.
Back to our idea of civility. There's a lot of incivility out there. Okay, you could say there's been incivility going on for decades, all right? I do not like or agree with the fantasy world created by some people that somehow before Trump got elected, like before 2016, we were all living in kumbaya, where like where everybody trusted the media and nobody, there were no problems, nobody was inflaming race relations.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Everything was just this beautiful thing, and then Trump popped out of a hole in the ground and said, fake news, and then we all lost our minds.
Right.
That,
right.
Like, that's nonsense. At least, you know, before CNN was called fake news by Trump, it was called the Clinton News Network by
Absolutely.
Limbaugh back in the 90s.
Sure.
Right? I mean,
that's right.
There, and you could even argue, I mean, Thomas Jefferson, like, at first thought, I think there was some statement, I think it's maybe Weaver as well, but there was some statement he made where he would rather have newspapers and no government than government and no newspapers. But then, like, I can't remember, like, some years into his presidency or some years into his, after the state, he wrote, I think, to John Adams saying that, you know, he's given up all the newspapers and is just going to read, like, Euclid and stuff
right,
like that and be happier for it. I mean, even all the way back to our founding, there's a sense of, you know, newspapers and, like, the media is somehow not healthy or not good or, like, it always falls apart. So there's always been this sort of contention there.
Right.
Right. There's always, it seems like there's always been conflict, and some people bring that up to be like, well, it's all okay. I'm not sure if it is okay.
But, and let me just say that I think the other thing that Weaver would point out is that the sort of marketing aspect of it all, mm-hmm. so that if the newspaper has a weakness, it survives on sales, and if it survives on sales, then it wants to write things that are going to sell papers, and so that's where you get to the if it bleeds, it leads kind of attitude, right? That sensational front page material will sell papers better than boring truth.
When ratings determine what story we get told.
Exactly. And I think that happens on cable news all the time, too.
To the idea of being your own editor. So, like I said, there's always been, like, contentious stuff and contentious opinions and people frustrated with newspapers and media outlets and radio personalities and TV personalities. There's been people frustrated with that forever.
Sure.
But, like, being your own editor, like, being able to sift through that and stuff like that, well, that requires, I feel like that requires at least two things. Okay, and this ties back into civility because I feel like civility requires these two things.
Okay.
All right. One is, first of all, you have to actually know how to argue.
Uh-huh.
And that doesn't just mean, like, how to speak an argument, but also how to hear an argument and unpack it correctly. Because
mm-hmm.
if you don't know how to argue, you don't know how to speak or to hear an argument, then you lack the ability, or at least you're going to have problems with the ability to separate a person and the idea that they're saying.
Quite right.
Like, when you actually know how to, you have a basic understanding how to gauge an argument, then when someone presents an idea or an argument, you can deal with it rather than them exactly.
Right.
So there's not always the case, but it's more likely that you're going to, like, just deal with the idea rather than them. If you don't have any argumentative skills,
mm-hmm.
don't really, then the only thing you actually know how to deal with is the person.
Right.
Like, that's it. That's all you know how to deal with. And if they say something you don't like, and you don't know why you don't like it, or even if you're not liking it is correct or not, you don't know what else to do except deal with them. And that can turn into anything from the worst form of, like, vilification, like, nasty name-calling, all the way to, like, tone policing or something like that.
Yeah, right.
But you're not dealing with the idea, you're dealing with the person, and that's an easy way to lead to a lack of civility, because it's easy to, like, want to attack a person or just support a person you don't, you know, who you shouldn't.
If the thing you need to learn about is the distinction between the argument and the character or the person making the argument, then when somebody opposes your position, your first instinct is to think he's one of them.
Yeah.
He's one of those guys.
Them.
Yeah, whoever they are.
With the quotation marks.
Yeah. That means I now have to deal with you as like an evil person. Not you're my enemy, a person who holds a position that I need to
some
consider.
Faceless stormtrooper in the Empire.
Exactly.
You know,
you're not
a person with a complex issue.
And that's the case on both sides. You know, in the political realm, you hear that on both sides.
Right. And that leads to the second thing. It's like, so you need argumentative skill.
Okay.
On some level. But the second thing you need is some sort of moral framework by which you see, regardless of what ideas they have, you see the dignity and worth of the person.
Amen.
Like that's got to be there. Something that, like, outside of all ideas they have, you see the person as inherently dignified and valuable. That's
right.
Where inherently valuable. You need that.
That's right.
So
that's right.
Being your own editor and being civil requires you to be able to understand argument in some level, so you can sift through arguments and ideas rather than people, and having some sort of moral foundation for respecting people.
Uh-huh.
All right. Now, the reason I bring that up is because if you lose both those things, for whatever reason, when you lose that, then of course incivility is going to happen, because you can only deal with people, and all those people are a bunch of outsiders.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if they say something I don't agree with or isn't familiar to me, then it must be a threat.
Right.
Right? Or they're one of them. Right.
And if the threat is serious, and you are taking that other person as less than, well, human, then you get very quickly into wars.
Get into wars. You get into...
Or genocide.
Or on another and insidious version of it, you get into demanding for an editor.
Oh, right, yeah, right,
that's for
everybody.
That's not you, it is not them, but it's some editor larger than everyone else that gets to filter everything.
Right, right.
Because we can't be our own editors, because we've, like, abdicated that responsibility or didn't even know we have that ability to do so. And so it's like, well, we need some larger edit. We need watchmen,
yeah.
Right? You know, we need, you know, the who watches the watchmen type thing. Well, we need those watchmen to come up here and watch for us, because we can't watch for ourselves.
Right.
Some reason. I need watchmen who will protect me from all those daggum conservatives on the internet. So shadow ban the ridiculousness out of them or something.
Sure.
I need some watchmen to protect me from all those awful progressivist nonsense. So give me Conservapedia or something like that. You know, it's the old principle that when you abdicate your own responsibility, then you allow for some larger force to do it for you.
Yes.
Right. And I feel like, to me, that's the couple things. One, that's one of the real dangers of a lack of civility, is that we want civility. But if we're not going to do it in ourselves, then we're going to demand somebody else do it.
Sure.
Who's bigger than us. And that's an open door to all kinds of trouble. But the second thing is that larger editor, with a capital E, whoever they are, can't actually make us civil. Right,
because it's an interior thing.
Because they can't really teach us argumentative skills, but they certainly can't make us see the value of another person.
Right, exactly.
See, that's a different thing. So it's like,
if those two things are necessary, then an external editor won't be able to make us do that.
Precisely, and so I think a lot of the debate about civility on social media, and again, we could talk if you want to about, is social media helping those two points of civility?
Mm-hmm.
Is it helping with our argumentative skills or hindering it? Is it helping with our seeing the value of other persons, or is it hindering it? There's probably pros and cons on both sides of that. I think that's the bigger danger. It's not just we'll tear each other apart, but that in starting to tear each other apart, we will then turn and say, we want somebody to fix this, and we're going to ask for somebody bigger. It's an old thing that, like, chaos breeds tyranny. You know.
That's right. I was going to say, it's very much like the political problems that people have. If you aren't going to govern yourselves, then you're going to need a police force and a justice system that's going to govern you. Mm-hmm. And if you're not going to adhere to them, you're not going to listen to them, then you're going to have chaos. And nobody can survive chaos, so we'll have tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only way out.
Right. Do you think, so this, I guess, bringing it to a point, do you think, so how would we assess social media, something like Twitter or Facebook or something like that? I guess we'll stick with Twitter, because, like, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, they're different mediums in some way.
Mm-hmm.
Even Facebook, though it's writing, like, Twitter, or you could post pictures as well, but let's just say a Facebook post is like writing. It's still longer writing. So right. There's a capacity for unpacking
more characters
something.
Than the Twitter allows.
So let's stick with like Twitter, I guess, because that's the one. Is Twitter as a medium, conducive to civility as defined as like argumentative skill and recognizing the worth of another person, or is it non-conducive, or does it depend? Yeah. And I suppose we'd have to start with saying, what does Twitter actually do? Like, what is it actually for? Not just that larger meta thing of like, oh, creating connectivity is going to break down all the barriers and we're all going to be friends. What is the point of being able...
That's the funny thing about breaking down barriers. Sometimes breaking down barriers actually makes you enemies.
Right. It's the old good fences make good neighbors
That's
kind of
right.
thing.
That's right.
Aside from that utopia kind of naivete, what is Twitter... What is the point of having a written medium where you can just shoot out what was originally 120 characters, now it's like 240, I think.
Oh, has it gone up?
Yeah, they doubled it. So, which, you know, made people mad because there's like, Twitter is, you know, empowering white supremacy by, you know, giving them more characters.
What?
I just, you know, whatever.
Wonderful.
You see, like, once, you know, we can't trust the other person to, like, be civil. So, and we seem to, like, have abdicated the responsibility of being civil. So, Twitter, we demand you enforce civility.
Oh,
by,
I see.
Whatever.
Right.
But what is the point? And this is not a leading question. I'm curious.
Yeah.
Rhetorically, artistically, communicatively, what is the point of being able to blurb a quick little 120 character or 240 character just shot like that?
Yeah.
And yes, I know for people who are listening that you can make longer threads that are numbered and stuff like that. But the main use of it is just quick little like blurb. Right. There it is. What is the point of doing something?
I can see a good thing. Sure. I'll start with the good things. I can see a good thing in it. Brevity really is the soul of wit.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a good thing for us to learn to be able to say what we mean to say in a few words.
Yes.
One of the great things about C.S. Lewis is that he could take very complicated things and boil them down into a sentence or two with an example and clarify the whole situation for me.
Right.
So I think that may be good if we were to be willing to live within the kind of limits that Twitter gives,
so,
and try and come up with a profound thought and not just an insult.
Well, in addition to that, even so, the brevity part of it can be conducive to clarity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I can see that because not just in like somebody says something profound, but if somebody says something stupid,
right,
it's clearly stupid.
Uh-huh.
Right? It seems like there is an argument to be made, and people could disagree with this. There's an argument to be made that it's hard to be obscure on Twitter. If I can put it that way, like it's hard. Not that you can't be, but if you tweet something that's just really vague and kind of general, it's probably not going to go very far. People are going to be like, "What do you mean?" or "What are you even saying?" But Twitter seems conducive to being pithy.
Yeah.
Like, just saying, this is exactly what I think and exactly what I mean. And thus, there's something there to actually respond to.
Sure.
So it's almost like because of brevity, there is this potential for the person's actual thought to be put in its lecherous form, and you can see it warts and all.
Sure.
And thus, somebody could say something very profound, or they could say something very stupid, but you can more clearly see how stupid it is.
And in addition to that, yes, I agree. And in addition to that, I guess... It could be a place where a kind of a Socratic dialogue actually takes place. So if you're pithy in your original post, and I'm pithy in my response to it, and we actually work back and forth to get clearer and clearer to truth, well, then it could be the equivalent of a Socratic dialogue. In other words, it has the potential for that.
Yeah,
I think the problems with it are... First of all, that it has no governor. It has no editor. It has no... And I don't mean to say that an individual, you know, needs to have an editor or a governor. What I mean is, because you can just type out something impulsively, you don't think about it a lot of times. So it allows for lack of reflection.
Right. So, like, you mean like an internal editor of some kind?
That's what I mean. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It doesn't have any... It doesn't, even if you had to write it out longhand, it would be better.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just because more time goes by, even if it's only a minute or two. I think it's very tempting when all you got to do is type quick when somebody says something inflammatory, somebody says something that you don't like, you can impulsively respond,
especially with like
without any governor,
especially with texting shorthands. You know, it's really easy to just say "you are stupid, lol," with like no capitalization and no punctuation, and just boom, send it out.
Exactly.
And we're doing great sound effects, by the way.
I like that.
We do our sound effects. Just send it out and hardly think about it. So it's like the instant. It's a case where like the immediacy of the medium. There's one of the problems of it is that it doesn't give you a sense of, it doesn't cause you to slow down.
Right. That's
like,
right.
Again, it depends on the person. Like there may be a thoughtful person who like types out something and then goes back and reads it and then edits and types it out again or something like that. If you're a nerd like me,
yeah,
something
I've like been known to do that too.
But there is nothing stopping you. That's the key. There's nothing other than yourself, other than the own thing, the own character you bring to it. There's nothing stopping you necessarily from just being super unreflective and uncritical, just throwing something out there that makes absolutely like zero sense or is zero helpful,
right,
put it that way,
right,
to
right.
the conversation.
The other problem with it is that there is no repercussion for attacking the person. Mm. You can say, I disagree with you for these reasons, fine. Or you can say, you're a complete idiot, and just do an ad hominem attack, and there's really no recourse. Because it's now public. And you can actually damage other people that way, you know, in the eyes of the people who are reading. If I write something nasty about you, suddenly all the people that are reading our conversation begin to ask, well, I wonder if Jack's really like that.
Yeah.
And I may be completely lying about what it is. You know, you're a 10-foot tall bald man. And they've never met you, but now they have this idea. I wonder if he really is.
Well,
you know?
Now they do.
What? Oh, oops.
Now that we changed our logo, nobody knows what I look like. I could be anything.
So anyway, and you can say things like that, and you can cause trouble, you know, and division without intending it, like I just did in there. Mm. He's not 10-foot tall bald man, just so you know.
You slanderous.
Exactly.
Slanderous.
Well, I mean, don't you see that that's a possibility when it's one thing if you and I are exchanging letters with each other and we're the only one reading them or we have control over who does read them.
Yeah.
But if we put them on something that's a public format like Twitter seems to be and loads of people can sign, I guess you have some kind of, can you limit who sees?
I don't use Twitter. I don't know. I know that in Facebook you can make events private and just with only
you
certain
could have
people.
Private
and posts can only go out necessarily to your friends if you want to. But on Twitter, I mean, it depends. It gets out there.
Do you have any control over who it is that actually signs on to read your posts?
On Twitter?
Yeah.
I don't.
Can anybody say, I want to read
President Trump's
tweet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like, yeah. Everybody. Yes. Everybody can read
but
everybody's.
Could the White House say, yeah, but I don't want Hodges reading them?
I don't think I don't think there's anything they could do about it. I mean, if the more famous a Twitter account is, the more follows it gets, the more retweets, the more like it gets posted out there.
Yeah, gotcha.
So if you're just sort of Joe Schmo who has like, you know, 30 followers and they're just your friends, then it's most likely only your friends are going to really notice what you tweet.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, when you tweet something, it's out there. You know, it's there. Especially if you like hashtag onto something that's part of a larger conversation. It's part of that larger conversation and people can find it if they search for that hashtag.
I see. Right.
So no, there's no way. I don't think there's any way to make.
So it's basically public.
It's public. Now there's a certain etiquette out there that I don't know how many people follow, but there's an etiquette that if there's an individual person you have a problem with, there's got to be a way you can message them, which is different. Like you can message them rather than
sending
a tweet.
Well, that would be one-on-one.
That's one-on-one. That's like message them or I don't know how that would work on Twitter. It would have to be if they have like an email present or if they have a messenger account present that you can get on.
Yeah.
But as far as tweets, they're public.
Like, okay.
They're out there.
Yeah, well, that's kind of what I figured. So you're saying something to a particular person, but you're saying it in, like I said before, in front of who knows how many people. It's all public, basically. You should never tweet anything that you don't want the world to read.
Yeah.
In fact, I feel that way about texting. I think there's probably a recording of our texts somewhere, too. And if you don't want people to read what you're trying to say to somebody, even personally, on these electronic devices, yeah, you shouldn't say it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's another way to do it. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that's what I'm trying to say is I think those are the cons about tweeting. There's the impulsiveness quotient or something.
Yeah.
And then there's the fact that it's public and that you can say things in that impulsive tweet that can do a lot of damage to the reputations of someone else. Mm. So,
or it can just add to the general nastiness of, yeah, of the conversation.
The decline in civility, the general civility, is going to be partly due, we don't know how much maybe to say, but partly due to this unlimited, impulsive medium that we have. So I think to some degree we can say that Twitter or Facebook or other media like that have been able to have had the effect of reducing civility in language and in treatment of one another.
The impulsiveness quotient, where we're going, the capacity for impulsivity.
Yeah.
All right. That Twitter, something like Twitter, aids in, because it really doesn't make you be impulsive. It's just there's nothing to stop you.
Right.
Right. So that sort of, it's like, so we could call it like it aids in impulsivity. It has an impulsivity allowance.
There you go.
Let's put that. That's our term, trademark, okay. Center for Western Studies. So Twitter's impulsivity allowance. You know, you could be pithy.
Yeah.
And, you know, very well put.
You don't have to be impulsive.
You don't have to be impulsive, right?
But you could be.
As a matter of fact, you know, jokes on Twitter can be amazing.
Yeah.
You know, like like really witty puns and cracks. It could be absolutely hysterical. So you don't have to be impulsive, but there's an impulsivity allowance, right? So there's nothing stopping you from being impulsive and uncritical and unreflective. That can adversely affect that first thing that civility needs, and that is argumentative skill. Because argumentative skill requires reflection and critical thinking on something and the ability to actually hear an idea and mull it over and understand it. Impulsivity just cuts through all that,
right?
So that attacks that. But it's the second thing, the lack of seeing dignity for the person, that I'm not sure that Twitter actually causes, rather than it was already there and Twitter just exacerbates.
Right, right.
Because the real reason why civility goes, well, actually, I'll get to that in a second. What adversely affects civility is first that loss of that moral framework. That, and I'll be specific, that Judeo-Christian moral framework that says every human being is made in the image of God. It doesn't matter if they're the most sterling saint you've ever met or they're the most wretched, racist, patriarchal neo-Nazi.
Yeah.
They are made in God's image, and they have inherent value and are worthy of dignity and respect on that ground alone,
mm-hmm,
regardless of what they think, okay, regardless of what they say. To be really controversial about it, the person who got run over in Charleston and the person who did the running over are both based in made in the image of God, deserve dignity and respect.
Charlottesville.
But Charlottesville. Charlottesville. Like,
right.
Both of them are made in the image of God, deserve dignity and respect. Now, the dignity, living out that dignity and respect may mean the one we give proper mourning and a funeral and the other one we throw in jail because we respect their moral choices and the responsibility placed upon it.
Sure.
But they both are to be someone treated with dignity and respect. There's that moral framework that gives that there.
We throw this, we go back to one of the points we were making at the very beginning, and I think that is, I agree with you that without the Imago Dei point, you're not going to have the same kind of civility. But I would argue that the medium itself contributes to that, too, in the sense that a virtual medium like that separates you from the person that you're talking to.
Right.
And in doing so, I think you actually lose, or makes it easier for you to treat him as less than a human being. I'll give you an example. I think the abortion issue has been like that. I think when the Roe v. Wade question was on the table back in 73, I was around back then, you weren't, but I was around back then, and I think people didn't have the ability that we have today to do ultrasounds of embryos.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a degree, a great degree, the population has fallen away from the notion that it's okay to abort children. It's moral to abort children, because of the fact that they've now been able to see into the womb and see the little guy with the little fingers and the little toes and looking like a real human being, a little real baby, at a far earlier time than they ever thought. See? Yeah. So if they're separated, in a sense, from the humanity of the person they're talking to, it's easier for them to...
Yeah, I agree with you.
Treat them badly.
It seems like we could say again that... you could argue that it hasn't caused the problem, but that it just does nothing to help.
Mm-hmm.
Not really. Like, it doesn't cause the degradation, but it does nothing to help the degradation.
I guess so. I guess what I'm trying to sort out is that the ability to, I guess, a handwritten letter does not necessarily recall you to mistreat another person. Right. I mean, by the fact that you're putting the letter in the mailbox and not saying it to him directly.
Right.
But I do think that the combination of the problems with Twitter, for example, can actually depersonalize your opponent. So it may be maybe it's the combination of the loss of the Imago Dei in our worldview to begin with, coupled with the impulsivity and the distance, absentee other person.
Yeah, the in absentia type thing.
Yeah, right. Absentia. So there's no reason for it to encourage that Imago Dei respect.
Right.
So if you don't have it to begin with, this is maybe you're right in the sense that it's not going to get it for you.
Right.
But I actually think that it exacerbates the problem.
Yeah.
You know, if you've dropped the Imago Dei question to begin with,
and you step into Twitter,
then
there's nothing that's going to help you get it back.
Yeah. And so even if you have it, maybe this would be the experiment. If you do believe that the person is made in the image of God, does Twitter help you forget that?
Yeah.
You know, does it work you down away from it?
Then we could take that from Twitter and expand it to like other social media things. Like
I'm using that as an example.
Yeah,
of all.
I was just thinking, like, you know, if you read somebody's Facebook post, does it do the same thing? A YouTube video is interesting because depending on the video, you could actually see the person.
That's right.
Or you could hear their voice.
That's right.
You know, so like there's an added element there that may help. But like when you're dealing with we circle back around to like the question of writing itself, right? Like when it's just words on a page, there is some distance created between you and the person. We can argue about how much distance, but you're not looking at a face and hearing a voice. It's word on a page, right?
Right.
And so all writing in any way, shape, or form, whether you're writing like a treatise or just shooting out the lol, you're stupid, whatever. Contains within it the capacity to like create distance between you and the person who's reading. But we struggle with this all the time when you're trying to like teach literature to kids. Our teenagers and stuff. It's not just, you know, the difficulty of the language. They may totally get it. They may like read it, got the plot, got the points, I'm done.
Yeah.
And that's it. And never get to like an actual sense of like there's a life in the text that confronts you, and you have to confront it, and you have to get in dialogue with it. It's just a dead thing. Here's an object. I studied it. I got it. Here's my report. I'm done.
Yeah.
We see that all the time. So it's like it's a problem. It's an issue in even the medium of writing itself. That writing itself the argument could be that writing itself has the ability to depersonalize in and of itself because it's not the person themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think even letter writing can have certain limitations about getting across how you really feel, think, treat the issue or the person you're dealing with. So I love the two ideas that we need to encourage good argumentative skills that makes it possible for us to debate things without being, to the extent that we can, personal about it, attacking the person. It's always been in logic that's an informal fallacy, right? That ad hominem attack has always been that way. But we've forgotten logic. So that, and logic is certainly a big help in doing that work of learning to be a good debater. But the other thing is maybe all the more essential then, because if you have lost the idea that your opponent is actually a human being made in the image of God and deserves dignity, no matter what his position is on immigration or whatever the issue yeah. is, right? If you've lost that, then you may have lost civility altogether, or at least be on that slippery slope to losing civility.
Yeah, and if you step into a medium where you're not dealing with an embodied person, but a screen,
yeah,
then it is easier to just slide on down.
Like, I think like that's right. I think that's a good way to put it, that it's easier, even if it doesn't necessarily do it, if it doesn't encourage it, it does make it easier for you to make that mistake.
Very good.
Speaking of the restoration of moral culture, any recommendations, sir?
Yeah, well, actually, it's funny that we were talking about civility. I heard a podcast not too many days ago by a fellow called Michael Knowles. Have you heard of him?
Yeah, yeah.
He's with Daily Wire. And he did an entire podcast on the decline of the civility of language. He was speaking in particular about language. So I could point everybody to that, I guess. That's worth hearing.
Right. He has it's his own podcast. I think it's called the Michael Knowles Show.
Michael Knowles Show with a K.
Yeah.
Knowles. The other thing I might recommend that I've heard recently, I've been listening to podcasts since it's been holiday and so on, is a group podcast by these same Daily Wire guys. Daily Wire?
Yeah.
Daily Wire. Daily Wire guys, Ben Shapiro and
Andrew Klavan, and Michael Knowles,
and their editor and boss, I guess, who is a guy called
Jeremy Boring.
Jeremy Boring, thank you. That's right. Anyway, the four of them got together and talked about Independence Day and the importance of Independence Day and the birth of our country. And I thought that was really well done. It's actually about a two-hour thing. The first hour, they talk amongst themselves. The second hour, they bring on a guest. And that takes them away, in a sense, from the topic. So the first hour is the one I'd suggest. Jordan Peterson is always very interesting, and he came on.
Right, he came on later.
But the first half of it is what I'd recommend. I thought that was very good.
All right. Well, for me, I guess we'll stick with the podcasting thing.
Okay.
And we'll stick to Jordan Peterson as well, now that you mentioned him. So for an example of, I don't know, not civility, like how the thing falls apart. So Jordan Peterson has a podcast, and I don't care what you think of him, agree or disagree with him. That's kind of the point. Like, you know, you don't have to agree or disagree with them. Just like listen and engage.
Yeah.
On his podcast, which is called the Jordan B. Peterson Podcast, episode 52 is called the Munk Debate, the M-U-N-K, Munk Debate, which is some sort of debate that happens in, well, it happened this time in Canada. I'm not sure if it's a Canadian, like, academic debate thing. But he went there with, it was him and Stephen Fry on one side, the British comedian guy.
Atheist, I think.
Yeah, atheist, but also Oxford educated.
Very intelligent fellow.
And on one side, and the other side, Michael Eric Dyson and Michelle Goldberg. And the subject matter was about political correctness. All right. Mm. Is political correctness good or bad for society? And it's like a 2 hour long thing, but most of it is like, you know, there's a lot of preliminary stuff and like, you know, hi, how you doing? Here's our sponsors. But when you get to the actual debate.
Yeah.
I recommend this not because it's a great example of civility or not because it's a great example of like ideas being shared, but because it is a perfect example of what good arguing and what bad arguing looks like.
Ah.
Okay, it's a good argument. And I won't spoil it and say who is or who at least I think was good at it or who was bad at it.
Mm-hmm.
But go listen to it and don't listen to it because it's going to be a discussion about political correctness because honestly, it was not. Go to it and listen to it and see what clear articulation and bad articulation sounds like.
Good, good.
Right? So it's episode 52 of Jordan Peterson's podcast. If you're not subscribed to it, that's fine. You can just find his podcast and just listen to the episode. It's called The Munk Debate. And listen very carefully and see who you think was the best arguer there and who was the worst, because it's an interesting way to stack them up.
And it would be a way then to hone your skills in that first category we've been talking about.
Yes, that was actually I listened to it and it so stupidly frustrated me, like what was going on in there, and I won't say why because I don't want to taint the audience pool, but I still was glad to listen to it because trying to articulate why it frustrated me and what I thought was going wrong and why it was going wrong actually helped me. Like, because then, but I could articulate why it was going wrong, what was happening, and I was like, well, if I was there, what would I say? So then I had to start thinking about political correctness and what I thought it was. And
right.
So it's a great like analysis for you of like argumentation and what it looks like when it goes right and what it looks like when it goes wrong. And so I recommend that as like an intellectual exercise for
everybody. Very good. Very good. Yeah, it sounds good. That's one of the things I like about our Sunday night discussions, and you and I both try to help them understand how to argue their points and to hear the other side's points, not just rant. So, very good.
Well, that's all the time we got for today. We thank you guys for listening to us. This has been From the Center, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.